Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to Inside Scoop Live. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I'm your host, Juanita Watson, and my guest today is author Kalpnik. He is here to talk about his new book, Artificial Imagination. Kalpnik was born in India and came to the U.S. on a fellowship from the University of California to pursue graduate-level studies and research in computer science in the late 80s. After completing his graduate studies, Kalpnik worked at both large technology companies and small startups in Silicon Valley, Seattle, and Southern California. He has been writing a journal about his journey through the U.S., and he finally decided to get it published as a book. Kalpnik has been described as an observer of people, places, and culture. Not only is he able to point out their uniqueness, oddity, eccentricity, and special characteristics, like a good comedian, he cleverly stretches it for humorous effect, making his audience crack up page after page. And you can find out more about Kalpnik and this book, Artificial Imagination, at his book's website, artificial-imagination.com. So with that said, welcome to the program, Kalpnik.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Oh, great, great. So your main focus really has been in the technology industry for, I think, about the last 20 years. So where and when did your interest in writing books begin?
It's actually happened right away when I arrived in U.S. Before that, I was really, in my family, I was known as a bookworm. So I was always reading books, but I never really even thought about writing one because, you know, I was really almost a math genius kind of a person, not a writer. But when I arrived in U.S., the whole enormity of the cultural changes happened. I was 21. I wasn't really ready for, when I sat in that plane, I thought things would be really all nice, and I didn't realize that it actually will be difficult. And I'm not talking about financial difficulties, but just adaptation. And to make it worse, I did, you know, what 21 years old usually do, although I should not have done that. I fell in love the very first 3 months in the United States with a native. So, so that emotional churn led me to write my, in place of, this is kind of difficult to write in a letter to friends on what's happening, you know. So I wrote it actually as a story, which was really amazing and interesting. And the characters in that story, one of them was, of course, really me.
So which book was that?
That is the chapter Artificial Imagination of book Artificial Imagination.
Oh, okay.
So I did not write a separate book. It was just a story, and I kept it with me for 20 years. I mean, I wrote it. It was good, funny. I realized I didn't know before then that I had a sense of humor. But I did not write for another 14 years, and then the next time, I think two things happened. The big meltdown in Silicon Valley happened. I was by that time a vice president in PeopleSoft, which is a pretty big Silicon Valley more than $1 billion Silicon Valley company. And when when I was being tossed around by the downturn in the technology industry, I just found that story after 14 years, and suddenly that click, both the turbulence of the times and the fact that I wrote before kind of catalyzed writing again. So I started writing again, and over the next 6 years, I wrote. Most of the writing was done, you know, but it was really truly based around my true experience, where I took some liberties of stretching the truth. It was really shared with friends.
Mm-hmm.
So the book has that very informal style from the get-go. You feel like you're talking to a friend.
To a friend. Your writing must have been and must still be a great creative outlet for the work that you do that is, you know, very logical, very focused.
Yes, it provides a good contrast, and it gives me a way, you know, me to exercise the other half of my brain. So my specialty and my job and what I'm really good at or make my, you know, primary livelihood is analytic abilities, right? So
mm-hmm.
I'm good in maths. I'm good in logic. I like analyzing, making decisions as an executive. And the writing gave me a creative outlet. Both times it was catalyzed by big changes in my life. First, you know, moving from India to the United States, and second time, just, you know, I didn't really move when I started writing again, but just going through the roller coaster ride of the mid-90s in the technology industry.
Mm-hmm. A lot of ups and downs in that industry.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, mm-hmm. There were friends who overnight, who became millionaires in a couple of years just because their company's stock value rose and they had stock options. And then overnight, we're back to ordinary people. As the, you know, you wake up and find the stock value, which was $40 yesterday, is $5. And then they call and say, "Oh, did the stock split?" No, the value fell down because the company missed its estimates.
Oh.
So that was really very, very tense moment for those of us who were in that industry.
Yes, absolutely. So let me ask you, why write under a pen name? Kalpnik is not your real name.
Yeah, Kalpnik means imaginary in Hindi, which is a very good, you know, fictitious name. Hey, a fictitious name, which means fictitious name,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
is a good pen name. Yes, I want to separate out and be able to take liberties and be very frank to my readers, whereas, you know, being in an executive position in technology industry means that I have to kind of adhere to certain professional codes and protocols and not talk about certain things and, you know, always be ultra respectable, which I understand, and I do want to be able to do that. So separating the two, and very few people actually realize, you know, that I don't really discuss it at work, and my personal friends do know about it, but my professional friends don't.
Oh, is that right? How interesting. Mm-hmm.
It's one of those secrets, and of course the thing is, when I go out for which I did you know, a few months ago for TV interviews and need to take daytime a day off, then it's
mm-hmm.
becomes interesting on how to explain that away.
Yeah, that's going to be interesting in the future as you produce more books and you get more popular. That could be quite a challenge.
Then it's less of an issue, right? I mean, if you end up with the next Kite Runner, then the doctor was actually, he quit his job. He was in Northern California as well. Yeah, the issue is, if I'm not popular, but people can, you know, you don't, and it allows, it just gives me a different mindset. I'm always, as my real person, I'm always careful about how to present and how to think, what's the appropriate way of presenting a thought, whereas as Kalpnik, I really become a separate person.
Well, that's so interesting. So when you write, tell us a little bit about your writing style. Are you writing every day at this point? And is it away from work and in your own home office where you can really embrace that persona of Kalpnik?
Yes, exactly. And I tend to write in spurts. So it's not, there are many, you know, people who emphasize you should write something every day. And to me, that's too regular. My writing and even my style is ad hoc and kind of, you know, my real life requires a lot of discipline, and this is my break away from that. So, of course, I don't write 1 hour every day. I write, but when I write, it's like for 30-hour stretch, you know, I would be just writing, sleeping for 4 hours. My wife will just write me off as a crazy dude, you know, and say, oh, he has gone crazy again. And, you know, I'm writing, and in some cases, tears are flowing out of my eyes or, you know, I'm laughing and talking to myself. So I write in spurts, and they are very intense. And usually something catalyzes them, you know, a job change or some incident happened or, you know, location change. I have moved around 4 or 5 times. And as I said, a lot of people may, actually we are going through that kind of an economic downturn again. But this is really hitting all of us, but it's really, the core of it is the financial industry. Whereas the last one, the core of that was the technology industry.
Mm-hmm. So this isn't as stressful for you.
Kind of, you know, made some. So those kind of things happened. And for example, we had a big fire in San Diego in 2007. So that did catalyze writing because that was you know, something interesting. And there I actually did write as it happened because, you know, it was happening and we were surrounded by fire on three sides. And there was really the San Diego County was, you know, at one point in time, 60 to 70% of it was considered evacuation area. It was just for a few days, but, you know, because it was very wild and it wasn't like all of it was burning, but they calculate the wind speed and how fast it could spread. And then, of course, they have to be careful. So it became a pretty big area and the sky was dark during the day. So something like that happens, you got to write about it.
Of course.
By writing spurts, it happens every 3 to 6 months. Something catalyzes me for small spurts and, you know, the bigger incidents, of course.
And so like situations like the fire that you experience, this is all included in Artificial Imagination?
Yes, it is. Mm-hmm. And it covers 5 cities across the United States, over 3 states, and covers from age 21 to 42. So it's really written over a wide time period. And but when I'm, you know, the one interesting thing is when I'm Kalpnik, I'm ageless, you know. I'm really taking liberties which a writer feel entitled to, and I'm really commenting frankly on things I see. The language becomes slightly more mature, but the style remains kind of the same humorous style. And I was actually very surprised that I had humor in me. I always like reading humor, but this was the first time when I was actually writing it. In my real life, I'm known as a very serious person.
Oh, really? So you discovered a new side of yourself.
It was one of those, you know, contrasts, a natural contrast. Some part of me just wants to be create that contrast to the rest of me.
Well, this book really is said to be a mix of humor, technology, and philosophy. So is this sort of indicative of your trademark writing style, or is it just this book, Artificial Imagination?
That is my trademark writing style, because that's what's ended up happening over a, you know, over a large period of time. That's how I've always written. As I said, I do have a serious side. I was a fellowship student. I am a Mensa member, so I'm definitely capable of deep thoughts. So that does come out here and there. But at the same time, I also, or at least a side of me, protests against taking life too seriously, and that comes out in my writing as well. A lot of the humor is, you know, it's silly humor. It's not the you know, most complicated humor. Some of it is just situational, you know. Some of it is, a lot of it makes fun about my experiences as an immigrant, funny situations because of my accent or the way I look. And it's, you know, it's basically to lighten the conversation up. But then, of course, on the serious side or the philosophical side, I wonder about, you know, what does life really mean? Why am I having to go through such changes when I, you know, travel or at least have to move again and again because of economical reason, go and kind of mentally survey or study the impact of people, you know, who move on the lives of people who move every 4 or 5 years versus people who stay in the same city they were born, you know, rest all their life. So that's comes out as a, it gives you a, you know, a unique insight into life. And also gets you to learn some habits. You know, one of the things, again, I found that humor allowed me to, you know, break in the ice quicker with people, especially given that I'm a foreigner. It was really difficult for me to mix in with people. But then very early I realized that despite my accent and cultural differences, people respond to humor pretty quickly. And most, there are some things which are funny for one culture and not at all funny for the other, but most of the humor, you know, fortunately does stay the same, and I found that was a great way for me to overcome that cultural barrier. It's not like people are saying, I don't want to mix with an Indian, but, you know, there are very few things you can talk about. I was a teaching assistant, and people, you know, were at University of California, were from all parts of the world. So how do you break in the ice, and what do you talk about? I don't watch the sports, and, You know, and what I found was humor was, I was able to really break that barrier, make people friends sooner. Again, it wasn't really right away, but it took time. And also crossed the language barrier, because as people are tuning their ears, you know, part of this is their disbelief. Did he really said that? Because, you know, or did we miss her because of his accent? And it makes that double interesting, which of course doesn't come out in a book, mm-hmm. because, you know, book doesn't have an accent, but it was really an interesting way, and it was my way to play around with, you know, my situation.
Yes, making the most of it. So humor then was pretty much the strongest way you were able to adapt to new people, local customs. I mean, like you say, you did move to a lot of different places in the U.S., which were very different places.
Yes, and it allowed, it was one of the tools I used, of course. If you are the funny guy all the time, that doesn't work either. And yes, I did move around, and what you find is that the experiences I had in California in 1987, I had a repeat of them. So in the 20 or 15 years I was here, I'm back in California, by the way, but, you know, the population, especially population of Silicon Valley, changed substantially, where I was no longer really the, you know, the odd person out. We are a minority state. But when I moved to Seattle and then to Nashville, those were almost like living the 1987, you know, again, because it was really, you know, the same issues. People had difficulty understanding me. I was still, you know, much smaller, technically a much smaller percentage of the population. That does not automatically mean people weren't friendly or they were hostile, but does mean, though, that I was the one who was different, right? Which was a feeling which we had early in the late 80s when I came to California, but it subsided in California to a great extent over the years.
Mm-hmm. Well, it must have been an initial culture shock when you did first come to the United States, and then little mini culture shocks every place you moved to.
Exactly. And it was almost a repeat, and, you know, you have to restart. And like Nashville, very first time we went to a restaurant and, you know, out of habit we started talking in Hindi in a restaurant. Not a big deal, right? In California, everyone is talking in a language you don't understand and you just shrug your shoulders and say, okay, that's what happens here. But we realized, both my wife and me, and I don't know about kids, but we became aware of the fact that everyone was looking at us. Who are these guys riding in what language? And don't get me wrong, I mean, Nashville is racially diverse, but, you know, it's really why they had a lot more African Americans compared to California, but they all speak the same language with almost the same accent.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So do you have a favorite place that you've lived?
People ask me all the time, and it's difficult to say that just because every place is unique and different. And we got, you know, love and friendship everywhere. And every place has its own unique characteristics. Of course, Silicon Valley, being a technologist, does remain my favorite for many, many reasons. It has remained, despite the big downturn of, 2001-2003, it actually sprung back with Google and, you know, other stuff, and it still remains, you know, near my heart. It is very expensive to live there, though. So that is a big negative, and you can pretty much buy three times the house or just have one person work in a family anywhere else. Whereas in Silicon Valley, it's really, really very expensive, you know, to live there.
Mm-hmm. I live in Austin, Texas, and we have a major migration of Californians coming here, and that's really one of the reasons why, because of the cost of living is just so high in certain areas in California.
Exactly, and pretty much the model assumes that, you know, if you didn't work for a Google at the right time and didn't make, you know, your $1 million, you can't buy a house in Palo Alto, which is Central Silicon Valley, $1 million just buy you a 1,200 square feet house.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. A small condo, really, pretty much. So that's what life is. But I like that just because it is technology industry. The weather is Just right.
Beautiful.
And I have a lot of friends there. It is a lot of the people from my undergraduate university. I have more classmates from my undergraduate university in India there. But that said, Seattle has its own, nice things. It is the most green place, and it has the most real contrast in people. People go from, being very sad and, I wouldn't say sad, but serious and kind of, reading books type to very outgoing in summers. And Disney claims, I'll use the Disneyland slogan, Seattle is the happiest place on earth during summers because everyone is so happy because it has happened after 8 months. Summer, lasts for 4 months. And it's also very beautiful in summer. I mean, it's beautiful all year, but summer, there are so many lakes and water bodies. They sparkle. It's very green, and the light reflects off the lake and off the faces of the people is how I think I described it. Nashville is different in a different way, a little bit more bucolic, but also more peaceful and serene, more natural. The population density, especially in the outskirts of the city, is less, and the city has the, fairly historic feeling to it. So every place has, and of course San Diego is known for its beaches and general Southern Californian culture. So every place has been really nice.
Do you ever go back to India?
We were going back. My parents are no longer with us. So I was going back every 2 years while they were with us. My wife does the same now. Now I go for business. I didn't go for 5 years, and then this whole outsourcing thing really took off. So mostly now I go. I mean, I of course pay a visit to my relatives, but it's now become a little bit more, once every 2 years, 1 or 2 mm-hmm. years, and it's usually a business trip.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll be back with more Inside Scoop Live after these important announcements.
Hi there. Are you looking for new ways to promote your book? Why not consider being interviewed live? With the huge impact internet radio as well as podcasting is making in our society, your voice can now be heard worldwide. Let Juanita at Inside Scoop Live create the necessary steps for you. You will not only receive a web page of your own, but your interview will be available for MP3 download and RSS feed. As well, your interview will be posted on venues such as iTunes, Blog Talk Radio, Podcast Alley, and the Inside Scoop Live blog. Go to InsideScoopLive.com today for more information. Welcome back to Inside Scoop Live. Just to remind you, I'm talking today with Kalpnik. He is the author of Artificial Imagination, and you can find out more about this author and his book through his website, artificial-imagination.com. So, talking about business and this whole technology field, you've been in the industry for so many years, seen so much change. Where do you see the biggest advances in the next, say, decade, and how are you going to fit into all of that change?
I try to keep up to date with the latest technology. I think the three big waves or the three, major things which are really happening is computing and devices at the micro level. People talk about, and some of it is already happening with phones, everyone is having what we call an IP address, but it's still kind of in a manual mode. I see that internet and everything will be connected, and when I say everything, not every person, but I'm really saying everything. Anything of worth, of value will automatically connect and respond. So, for example, and it's technically possible even today, but no one has hooked up around yet. But when you drive a car and when it reaches the low fuel indicator level, in addition to its being lighting that small indicator light up, somewhere on the dashboard, you'll have the option of automatically flashing the nearest gas station.
Mm-hmm.
The GPS technology is there.
Yeah.
The fuel indicator is there. Just hooking the two up and saying, you know, and saying, hey, dude, your gas is running out. Take the right turn to the next this thing and fill it up. People have talked about cars talking collision avoidance. That's people always, you know, they were all those reflective sensors and other things.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, addressability over the internet and even use of GPS could help you out there as well, because GPSs are accurate within a feet, and you know, unless it's really, you should not really be near another vehicle even within a feet at higher speeds, right?
Right.
So some of those things will happen. Again, remotely starting your while you're sitting at work, starting your you know, coffee maker at home or something like that has been possible for a while, but hasn't really been in the mainstream use. But I think some of those things will come into play. The social networking has moved kind of, you know, half into mainstream, but will really take with the new next generation, with our kids growing up, they would think of the world that way. They would not think of the world. The analogies will start reversing. You would not think of connecting with people first in person. You'll actually think of connecting and finding them over the internet first. And also virtual classrooms, also things like, again, use of geospatial devices, friends finders, and so for example, one of the technologies or tools we are talking about, I'm also a member of the geospatial committee here in San Diego, and one of the things we have been talking about is really Facebook connected with a GPS, so you know when you're walking which of your friends are in the neighborhood, and you get an alert right on your phone. And that's very possible and actually is going to happen. Just because it's possible, anything, it's like life, you know, when the conditions become right, life happened on Earth, and it's because, you know, it will. So when the technology is right, someone will think of it, and people will be working on it even before you know, and it will happen. So it's that kind of a thing. And, it's like, it's an exciting world. People are becoming more environmental aware. I see the green movement taking up and technology being used. A lot of people don't realize, but we are moving, again, although it's just a local move. But actually, eBay and Amazon are helping keep the land, you know, are saving the environment. People don't realize that, but the fact that I'm able to sell the stuff which I don't consider valuable for me myself rather than just throwing it away is actually, you know, saving the landfills. The fact that my, you know, surplus furniture is now going to be someone's main furniture, or my TV or computer in place of hitting the dumpster is going to be used by someone, is actually helping us. So in some ways it's helping you reuse, because, you know the person who is right there somewhere who can use that thing. And a lot of the reuse is just about finding that person.
Mm.
So that's also, technology is helping that way as well.
Mm-hmm. Such a fascinating time to be alive.
Yes, and you know, there are issues. There are, you know, apart from the kind of the politics of the day of terrorism and so on, environment, oil, economy are big issues, but technology, as usual, keep helping you, you know, bridge those.
Keeps moving forward, clearly. You know, you mentioned Amazon, and I know that Amazon has been really key in your whole marketing and promotion of Artificial Imagination and your other books. Can you tell us a little bit about your experiences with Amazon and Amazon Kindle?
Yes, let's first talk about the experiences with Amazon as an author, because that has been very positive, and I'll be honest there.
Mm-hmm.
Experiences as an employee, you know, were kind of mixed. I did not really work there too long. It was a little bit of an oppressed, very demanding environment. But as an author, I found Amazon to be a very, very nice experience. One of the nice things, we talk about Kindle, and that was actually part of the reason this book has happened. What happened was, I have been writing for a while, and I always, you know, said I'm a technologist. The idea of trying to publish it came every now and then, but I was really posting it emailing it to friends mostly. And some of them will say, oh, wow, very creative. You should consider writing. And it's like, no, dude, I'm too busy. And really, I haven't reached that level of writing skills yet. But when I read the article in Newsweek about Kindle, and that I had left Amazon a few years ago, you know, by then, and it's like, oh, now everyone can write, and it's the next iPod kind of experience where you are really, you know, singers can publish without having to go through the recording industry. That was very tempting for me, partly because, I mean, not because, you know, it's not my main job, and I am very time-pressed, so I just didn't see myself sending manuscripts, thick manuscripts to publishers and waiting. And I work in an industry where things move very fast, so I don't like the concept of waiting. It's very foreign to me. So Kindle really helped me publish the book right away. And for some reasons, and I can, you know, try to explain those reasons, the book actually did very well on Kindle. Artificial Imagination title is very catchy for the early adopters of a technology. So people who were the first buyers of Kindles were into gadgets, were into electronics, were readers, mm-hmm. were probably of a, you know, the right demographics, not too young, but, you know, still young enough to enjoy playing around with tools. So it was in the top 1% from the get-go.
Wow, great timing.
Kindle marketing was very difficult. Now you can try to, you know, buy, and Amazon is actually, that's one negative. Marketing on Kindle is tougher than marketing on others because you cannot really buy the word Kindle on search engines. You know, they would not sell it to you, and even if they did, you'll get an email from Amazon, especially if you are an author on Amazon, so they will hunt you down and say, you can't use that. But I did not do much marketing, and it took off, and which was, I did realize what the real, I mean, it's part of the reason is that the term artificial imagination, which is obviously a derivative of artificial intelligence,
uh-huh.
or at least a mock on that term in some sense, is really appealing to the gadget-liking population. So the book was first published on Amazon, a Kindle in electronic form, and then on paper. And that's what actually the success, the automatic success of the book, I shouldn't say automatic, but the fact that it did so well on Kindle is what
moved it forward.
Had me kind of going on the paper version as well, print version as well. For the print version, I also use Amazon company, which helped me kind of, you know, drive that without, again, going through complicated, waiting for a long time kind of a way. Being an Amazonian, I also knew, you know, some tools of the tricks of the trade of, you know, how to use the Amazon tools, the List Mania, and also their promotions, buy X, get Y kind of promotions.
They make it easy for an author.
Marketing a book is really very difficult for
in
this time. But, you know, it using the social media, using Facebook, using, blogs did help me. It's not easy, though. I mean, it's not for the, as they say, it's not for the faint of the heart. And I have done it mostly for fun.
You have to be so patient.
You have to be patient, but tools like Kindle, tools like CreateSpace, do let you gather a lot more speed than the conventional method. The other nice thing about being an author on Kindle is you can actually, you don't really have to wait 10 years for, you know, to your book to get to the shape where you are fully satisfied and then make one release. You're not building, you know, a car anymore. What you're building is Microsoft Windows. You release 1.0 version, then you release 2.0 version, you know, you get feedback from your first readers, you release the next version, then you release XP. So I did release it a bit in iterations. You know, you release it, you see how people react and read it. Of course, you need to get it to a certain shape before you put it out in the market.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost a dynamic experiment. I also changed the book cover
mm-hmm.
on Kindle because it's just an image which you can upload every, sometimes I change it within a month and sometimes no I don't keep a cover any longer than 3 months. I mean, a Kindle cover is not really a cover of anything. It's just an image.
Just an image, that's right. Well, you include many photographs in this book. Was that an issue when you were publishing?
Kindle, actually, yeah. It is a little bit of an issue on Kindle, but and the other negative of Kindle publishing is, and that's one of the primary reasons I did go and publish in print, is that it's all black and white. The Kindle technology doesn't use color. They use, it's very advanced for what they do in the sense that they avoid all some of the glare and reflection issues with the other display technologies. So they use a revolutionizing kind of digital ink technology where what you are seeing is on a non-glaring screen. But the negative is that it only supports black and white. So a lot of my photographs were in color, and to capture beauty of places like Seattle or California, you know, that's a negative. The image formatting is a little bit of an issue. You really can't put an image exactly where you want in, you know, in relation to the words, which you can control in a print version. And, you know, and the issue with Kindle is even their editing tools don't really show how it will really look. They kind of get you close to it, so it's a very floating. You have to assume everything is floating, you know, on the screen.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, you have to untie, and you know, you cannot really like the photo which goes with the. Since I use humor, some of the photos really, like in one case, at least in the Nashville case, the photo is the punchline, and you know, in place of aligning it side by side, I had to align it next to each other, top to bottom, kind of a way.
So
that's still, you know, the satisfaction of getting it out much sooner kind of outweighs all those disadvantages.
Absolutely. Well, what is next for you?
I will, so here is the funny thought I had, and I've been thinking about what else to write about because I had only one life, right? I mean, unless I wait another 20 years, I cannot write my autobiography again. So I thought the next funny thing I could, and it has to be funny because in some ways that's my outlet.
Mm-hmm.
The humor is to, you know, I'm almost telling a joke to myself first. I think I will write about my experiences writing a book and publishing and marketing a book, you know.
Oh,
I think that's actually can be pretty funny at times.
Absolutely. You need to add a little humor into that. It can be a pretty weighty endeavor.
It is. And of course, for someone who is putting, you know, who that's what all they are doing and they spend 4 or 5 years just focused on this, it may be black humor, but for someone like me who is, you know, moving from one industry to another more as a hobby. For example, one of the funniest situations is I almost expected, you know, the Kindle success to come to my print version, but the print world works very, very differently.
Mm-hmm.
It's much more aggressive marketing. It's a lot more competitive and just to kind of for people to, the mentality is different. People want to see, you know, at least 10 other, I didn't realize that, but the normal marketing rule is people say that they have to hear that word or see that brand name 5 times before they'll actually buy it or, you know, hear or read about it.
Mm-hmm.
For books, it's 10 times.
Oh, really?
Right? Yeah, yeah. Someone did a study and say for most people to buy a book, they have to see the name or hear about it from their friends or read about it 10 times, unless, of course, it's a how-to or a focused technical book.
Mm-hmm.
But for most other books, that's how it works. So it's a lot more competitive, and, you know, that itself was kind of a funny, and there are a lot of funny situations. So I think my next book, I just need to come up with a clever title for it, would really be a book about writing a book, writing and more than writing, marketing and publishing. It has been a very interesting experience, though. For example, when I joined Facebook to look for a model for my book cover. So just chasing models, you know, and I'm early 40s. That itself was a very interesting experience on how they, you know, negotiate and react. I'm pleasantly surprised that people actually probably shouldn't be a big surprise, but it was a pleasant surprise that they were. And yes, they are hard to chase, but they are all actually, they want to be on a book cover. People want to be on a book cover.
That's great. Are you talking about the women that are on some of your covers?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's so interesting because the idea of women come up again and again as characters in your book. So I'm interested to hear why that is and just your thoughts on putting women on the front covers.
Yeah, it's the reason I put them is that the book actually, you know, when I come back and realize it really talks about my experiences.
Yeah.
And I try to cover the places, you know, mostly through women, and that's an interesting observation I made on myself. Of course, when I'm talking about Amazon, I do talk about Bezos, you know, but I do talk about my women colleagues. I think the primary reason, after thinking and drawing and computing, I think I have a genetic defect which, affects a very large percentage of the population. One of my chromosomes is Y, and that makes me a man, which for some reason, you know, makes women interesting for me. And, jokes aside, I mean, yes, I am attracted, but the other reason I realize is that they are the ones, always have been the ones, who made me feel accepted in a new place.
Mm.
For some reason or the other, it was an interaction. Maybe they are more curious, they are more understanding, they are more kind. But any time we moved, I always felt accepted in that new place. There was always a few women, you know, who made that gesture to me, who made me feel welcome, made me feel overcome by, and in many cases, just a offer of help, right? I mean, when I landed at San Francisco, I had to take a bus to University of California campus, and I was, you have to transfer between buses, and it's not exactly a transfer station. You kind of get out from the airport shuttle or airport bus at a certain point, and the transit station is two blocks away. Now, what is a block? You know, I'm 21, I'm out of India, I know English very well.
Mm-hmm.
What the hell is a block? Blocks? I mean, wood blocks? No, I didn't know what a block is, really. I mean, I didn't know. Well, block is not a term used in the same sense in India in English.
Mm-hmm.
Not sure about British, but Indian English is British English. So I'm running around and seeing, I don't see any blocks. I mean, you know, and how big are these blocks? You know, and looking for, and then there is this girl passes by and offers me help. So that's how I started, you know, the journey there. For Seattle, there is actually an incident which I mention in the book, which of course took, take a funny angle to it, and I won't describe it here, just leave something for people to read the book.
Yes.
So I think that's part of the reason, that the welcoming smile, for whatever reason they offer you help first. I was raised with two brothers, and I was a very, very shy. You know, I'm a geeky person, right? I read books and I did maths. And so I was really never I wasn't, let's say, not either interested nor very popular among women till age 20-something. And then I came to U.S. and I was still not very popular. And then, you know, but I found this humor. I found the fact that they were the ones who reached me to help me out. And then, of course, God, although I'm just using that term metaphorically, decided to either, you know, teach me a lesson or give me an interesting experience by giving me two daughters. So now, I'm very used to a 75% women majority at home. If anything, I take too much of an informal view with them, but yeah, they have helped me adapt and kind of, you know, have been a central place.
I'm sure you're a better man for having all those women around you.
Yeah, the three at home, definitely. And
yeah,
of course, as I described to people, the big difference in my childhood experience and my adult experience dealing with kids is that both use body fluids. Women or girls use tears to express their feelings or, you know, take out their frustrations. When you're dealing with boys, it's usually blood.
Oh, gosh. Good point. Good point.
Yeah.
Kalpnik, it's been wonderful talking with you. You've just been so interesting, very fascinating. I wish you all the success with your book, Artificial Imagination. And I hope that we get a chance to speak again when you come out with this next book about marketing and promoting.
A book, yeah, writing a book, becoming an author, something. And, you know, if you think of a good title, or anyone listening to this thinks of a good title, email it to kalpnik@artificial-imagination.com, and I'll mention you in the book as the person who came up with the title. I'm really stuck on the title. I have the book all mentally planned out, but I really don't have a title for it yet.
A little writer's block.
Yeah, it's a little writer's block, and unfortunately, it's like it's mentally mapped out, but I can't write to it unless I have a title. I have one of those, you know, mental issues as well. Hey, write the books, think of the title later. No, I want to have a title.
That's funny. Well, this has been wonderful. Thank you so much for joining us today. You take care, Kalpnik.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, listeners, that's been Kalpnik. His new book, Artificial Imagination, is out now. And as mentioned, his website, artificial-imagination.com, and all of Kalpnik's books can be purchased through his website or through local and online booksellers. Well, I want to thank you for tuning in to this great, humorous, philosophical, very interesting interview today. So do tune in for next time. I want to thank you again, and I'm Juanita Watson. I'll see you again.